This is the Breaker.News podcast for March 18th, 2018. Welcome, I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this episode, regular features such as the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines from around the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines from around the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, Would It Be an Honor or a Burden to Host the 2026 FIFA World Cup, an interview with sports economist Victor Matheson, and The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo Bar to those who made a difference this week. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or are you also disappointed that soccer's 2026 World Cup will not be coming to Vancouver if FIFA chooses the United States-led bid for North America? There could have been three early-round games at BC Play Stadium in the 48-nation tournament, but the problem is not British Columbia Premier John Horgan, who said no to FIFA. It's FIFA itself. Quite simply, FIFA wants too much. More than the cash-strapped BC government can afford to deliver. FIFA wants host governments to give it a 10-year tax holiday. FIFA wants to import and export unlimited amounts of foreign currencies. FIFA wants exemption from labor laws. FIFA wants governments to pay for security. And that's just the start. Meanwhile, FIFA stands to pocket a $300 million bonus from rights-holding broadcasters if it chooses North America over Morocco at its June Congress in Russia. The organization is just 3 years removed from the massive FBI crackdown, which found more than $150 million was paid in bribes and kickbacks over World Cup bids, TV rights contracts, ticket sales, marketing, and merchandising deals. Sepp Blatter is gone from the presidency, but is new president Gianni Infantino going to run a clean shop? Can we trust Infantino yet? Blatter got the red card at the end of 2015, the year that Canadian taxpayers spent at least $27 million to subsidize the Women's World Cup. Meanwhile, Blatter was pocketing a $3.6 million annual salary. He took home even more than that because we found out about a secret four-year $80 million bonus scheme that he shared with three other FIFA bigwigs. Infantino became president in 2016. After his successful election campaign, that was bankrolled by his ex-employer, UEFA, to the tune of €500,000. That, and whether Infantino tried to influence the African Football Confederation election, were both under investigation by FIFA's Ethics Committee. That is until May 2017, when Infantino himself arranged for the gutting of FIFA's Ethics Committee. So, when FIFA tilts the playing field so heavily in its favor, why does anyone want to play the hosting game? Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Eric Ng and Sandy Lee report, billionaire tycoon Li Ka-shing retires, hands control of empire to son Victor. Li Ka-shing, whose life journey from humble beginnings to Asia's biggest business fortunes became the epitome of entrepreneurship that inspired generations of Hong Kongers, has announced his retirement after almost seven decades at the pinnacle of one of the world's largest corporate conglomerates. Also known as Superman to many, Li, who turns 90 in July, will hand over the chairmanships of his two flagship companies to his elder son, Victor Li. Younger son, Richard Li, will continue to run PCCW and not return to the CK Group, as he has many other businesses. In 1988, Li's Concord Pacific agreed to pay $320 million to buy the old Expo 86 site in downtown Vancouver. False Creek was eventually transformed, and Vancouver became a destination for billions of dollars of real estate investment from not only Hong Kong, but mainland China. In 1991, Li bought control of Husky Oil. 7 years later, he bought the Mohawk Oil fuel station chain across Western Canada. In the Los Angeles Times, James Quayle and Nicole Santa Cruz report, out of control, 17 years, 179 victims, the deadly toll of street racing in Los Angeles. Southern California has long been the epicenter of high-speed car culture. Wild police pursuits dominate TV newscasts. The Fast and Furious film franchise, which many cops blame for hyping street racing, was set in L.A. Police say incidents of street racing are on the rise, driven by popular culture and the use of social media to draw contestants and evade authorities. In what racers call takeovers, participants use their cars to block off streets or intersections to stage races. The deadliest year on record was 2007, with 18 fatal crashes. After a period with relatively few recorded deaths, the count grew in recent years, with 15 fatalities in 2015, 11 in 2016, and 12 deaths in 2017, the Times analysis shows. The dead were overwhelmingly male and young. More than half were 21 or younger, including two children ages 4 and 8, killed along with their mother. Slightly less than half of the victims, 47%, were behind the wheel. The rest were either passengers in the speeding vehicles, spectators, or people simply walking on a sidewalk or driving home. And finally, in the Fiji Sun, Asalini Rituva reports, Sevens bid progress on track. Doug Langley is happy with the progress Fiji has made in its bid to host a leg of the World Sevens Series in 2020. The World Rugby Sevens Series director concluded a two-day visit to Fiji. The purpose of the visit was to inspect the various facilities put forward by the Fiji Rugby Union in its submission. A decision on future hosts of the World Rugby Sevens Series will be made on June 28th. Vancouver joined the series in 2016 and wants four more years. Fiji beat Kenya to win the HSBC Canada Sevens Rugby Sevens Cup at BC Place Stadium in Vancouver on March 11th. The event drew 78,000 fans over 2 days and has become the city's marquee annual sporting event. The only blemish was that the stadium's retractable roof stayed closed during the calm, sunny, and mild pre-spring weather. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time for Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Mike Rogoway reports, Nike shakeup follows conduct inconsistent with Nike's core values. Top Nike executive Trevor Edwards left the company abruptly on March 15th, following what the sportswear giant described as conduct inconsistent with Nike's core values and against our code of conduct. Edwards, 55, served as the company's brand president. He'd been with Nike since 1992. He was seen as a potential successor to CEO Mark Parker. Nike, headquartered near Beaverton, Oregon, issued a public statement describing Edwards' exit as a retirement. But a staff memo from Parker suggested there was a lot more to the story. Over the past few weeks, we've become aware of reports of behavior occurring within our organization that do not reflect our core values of inclusivity, respect, and empowerment, Parker wrote. This disturbs and saddens me. Greg Bell in the Tacoma News Tribune reports on the comings and goings from the Seattle Seahawks, who missed the NFL playoffs for the first time since 2011. The Seahawks have waived, traded, or let leave into free agency 10 former starters in the last 9 days. They are Michael Bennett, Richard Sherman, Jeremy Lane, Jimmy Graham, Paul Richardson, Deshaun Shedd, Mike Davis, Thomas Rawls, Luke Jockel, and Ode Abushi. Seahawks head coach Pete Carroll has vowed that his top priority for 2018 is getting his offense back to the run. Seattle has not had an adequate run-blocking tight end for years. Last season, the Seahawks didn't have a fullback either. The result of that was not only the NFL's lowest rushing production by running backs last season, but in many seasons. And finally, on News 1130, Hannah May Nassar reports anonymous tip line launches aimed at BC real estate misconduct. The province is hoping to make it a lot easier for you to report suspected misconduct in the local real estate market. A new anonymous tip line has been launched by the Real Estate Council of BC. There are fines of up to $250,000 under the Real Estate Services Act. People can report suspicious behavior by phone at 1-833-420-2400. That's 1-833-420-2400. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time for the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. In June, FIFA will choose the host of the 2026 World Cup. Only two bids are in. One is from Morocco. The other is the overwhelming favorite, a joint United States-Mexico-Canada bid. But last week, Vancouver, Chicago, and Minneapolis pulled out of the so-called United Bid Committee. First, British Columbia Premier John Horgan, then Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, had second thoughts about doing business with FIFA and about the uncertainty of the costs and benefits of the bid. Bid boosters claimed cities could be in line for a windfall of $90 million to $490 million of net benefits to their economies. But how reliable are those estimates? The Breaker.News podcast welcomes Professor Victor Matheson of the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts. Professor Matheson is a noted sports economist who has studied the impacts of mega events like Olympics, Super Bowls, and World Cups. He has found that mega events don't always live up to the mega hype. Welcome to the Breaker.News podcast. Is hosting the World Cup an honor or a burden?
So that's the real question, right? So obviously, if you believe FIFA and the supporters of the bid, what you're envisioning is huge numbers, hundreds of thousands of fans from across the world coming to Canada, coming to the United States and Mexico with fat wallets, spending lots of money on tickets, but more importantly, spending lots of money in local economies on things like hotels, on restaurants, on retail stores. And when you tally up all those numbers, people often envision numbers in the $4, $5, $6, maybe even $10 billion of benefit from hosting the World Cup. Unfortunately, when you actually look back at past World Cups, we don't see those sort of rosy projections actually occurring when you look at the real data.
The United Bid Committee, which comprises executives from the U.S., Mexico, and Canadian soccer federations, hired Boston Consulting Group. It estimated between $160 million and $620 million in incremental economic activity for individual host cities. They say that there could be a net benefit of $90 million to $490 million per city. And for a city with only three matches, it estimated a $90 million direct impact and $170 million net economic output. Now, these are very large numbers. Are they to be believed at all?
Well, so the real way to check that is see what happens in other cities back in the past when they have hosted these big events. So my colleague Robert Boddy and I took a look at 1994, which is, of course, when the World Cup was last in the United States. Similar to now, economic consultants were predicting maybe $4, $5, or $6 billion worth of positive net impact from hosting World Cup matches. But when we actually looked at economic activity of the cities that had hosted matches compared to otherwise similar cities that didn't have World Cup matches back in 94, we actually found the cities that hosted games did $4 billion worse, not $4 billion better, but $4 billion worse on a whole compared to what we would have normally expected from cities like them.
Can you talk about how the economy changes in a city when a host when it does host a mega event? It's not all people coming in and spending money. There's money that sometimes goes out of the economy.
Right. So the typical way you do an economic impact study is you try to estimate how much money is getting spent because of a World Cup match, and then how much that money is going to circulate through the economy then. But you have to watch out for a couple things. First of all, if Vancouver were to host games, if most of the people at those games are local Vancouver residents or local British Columbia residents, then that's actually not new money coming into the economy. That's just shifting around where the money gets spent. You hope for, in something like the World Cup, a lot of people coming from out of town. But even for a huge event like the World Cup, you're only talking usually about maybe 100,000 or 200,000 additional international visitors. That's what happened in South Africa when they hosted about 10 years ago. And you spread that out over 10 different cities, you're talking about a fairly small number of new people coming in. And then you also have to worry about, well, imagine you have all these soccer fans in town. They're staying and taking up hotel rooms, which is a good thing. On the other hand, if they're displacing tourists who would have been here anyways, then you actually don't get a positive impact. In fact, the city that did worse in our entire sample of cities in 1994, the very city that did worst by having the World Cup in town was Orlando, Florida. No surprise there. That's a place that in the summer is full of Disney residents. And what you had instead is thousands of soccer fans pouring into Orlando and displacing what would have otherwise been Disneyland tourists.
Most mega events do rely on a lot of construction. This one wouldn't from the outset, but of course, scope creep can always happen.
Yeah, so the great thing about hosting the event here in the U.S. and Canada is the fact that we have all the both tourist infrastructure and stadium infrastructure already in place. You compare that to Brazil last time out that spent over $3 billion on stadiums. Compare that to Russia that is looking at about maybe a $10 billion price tag to host the World Cup here this June. The United States and Canada are, of course, very well set having all this infrastructure in place. The problem comes that if FIFA says, oh, we want a nicer stadium, we want better stadiums, or that they demand extremely high levels of essentially service to their teams, to their dignitaries, to their officials. And then all of a sudden, what should be just plain you know, frosting for a city like Vancouver, that should be all free money coming in, instead all of a sudden becomes a burden.
And another burden that has happened because of worldwide events since 1994 is security. We saw here in Vancouver for the 2010 Winter Olympics, the original estimate was a $175 million security bill. It ended up being closer to $900 million. And these events are complex, and there are a lot of threats of varying degrees, whether it's you know, terrorism on one end, or on another end, it could be as simple as fraud and ticket counterfeiting. And of course, FIFA itself is a bit of a threat because of its reputation for corruption. Talk about that X factor of a security bill.
Yeah, so that's a huge issue. And of course, the one I also use is the difference between Sydney in the year 2000 and Athens in 2004. The obvious difference there is we have the dividing line of 9/11-2001 in between those. Sydney spent about $250 million on security. Athens spent $1.5 billion. So kind of a similar story of what happened in Vancouver, an increase in price of about a factor of six between those two events. One nice thing about the World Cup is it is a much simpler event than the Olympics. You're talking about a handful of events at only one location. Makes it much easier to secure than the Winter Olympics, where you have huge numbers of venues spread all across the province. So that makes it a little bit easier. That being said, yeah, there's no doubt that security has become, unfortunately, a huge issue with these mega events. Well over $50 million is spent securing the Super Bowl in the United States every year. So, you know, this is a huge price tag. And when you consider that imagine you have 50,000 fans at a soccer game. If you have to spend $50 million in security to protect them, that's like putting a tax of $1,000 on every ticket, right? And even if you say, well, it's not going to cost $50 million, it'll only be $5 million of security, that's still a tax of $100 per ticket just to keep people safe. You know, that becomes very, very pricey very, very quickly.
And finally, does it surprise you that cities like Chicago and Minneapolis and Vancouver have dropped out of this bid? Cities with viable stadiums, cities with large markets that are also large soccer markets that probably would have had a good chance of selling them out. Are you surprised at that, or is this just part of a worldwide trend now where governments are taking a second look at doing business with organizations like FIFA?
Well, yes. Yeah, so this is part of a trend. We saw in the latest bidding for the Olympics that we had five of the bidders for the 2022 Winter Olympics dropped out of the running. We had four major bidders for the 2024 Summer Games drop out of the bidding, so much so that that the IOC was worried that they would get any bidders at all for 2028, and therefore, actually, they awarded both 2024 and 2028 at the same time because they were worried about running out of bidders completely. That being said, I really am surprised. It really tells you how much governments have come to dislike these big international organizations like FIFA and the IOC, that something that literally should have no infrastructure cost at all should be all money pouring in without much expense, they're turning those things down. That really is a complete sea change. It's hard to believe that a Chicago with a brand new stadium that is otherwise sitting empty in the summer, that Chicago actually thinks it's better not to fill it full of a FIFA event, that it will cost more to actually use the stadium than to let it stay empty. And you know, that's a real surprise.
That was Professor Victor Matheson, sports economist from the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to those that made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to British Columbia's athletes from the PyeongChang 2018 Winter Paralympics. The games of ice and snow for athletes with a disability are now over, thus ending the PyeongChang Winter Sports Festival. These are the British Columbians who proudly wore the maple leaf in South Korea. Sledge hockey. James Gemmell of Quesnel and Greg Westlake of North Vancouver. Paranordic cross-country skiing. Ethan Hess from Pemberton. Emily Young from North Vancouver, and Natalie Wilkie from Salmon Arm, Para-Alpine, Alex Cairns from Squamish, Braden Luscombe from Duncan, Molly Jepson from West Vancouver, and Mel Pemble from Victoria, and in wheelchair curling, Ina Forrest from Armstrong. Those are the British Columbians from Team Canada at the 2018 PyeongChang Winter Paralympics. You can nominate someone too for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Well, that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for March 18th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. That's bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until the end of March, support The Breaker through Patreon and you will receive a free copy of my ebook, Red Mittens and Red Ink, The Vancouver Olympics. Again, that's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.